You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
This week's bits. The best news nuggets from Breakfast and The Wire from this week.
Morning everyone, ko hana rostok ko ingoa and welcome to this week's bits. This week we looked into the reporting of Tongan Rugby League supporters from the game last week. We also looked into Papua New Guinea's Manus Island a little bit more, and 95BFM news team Elisa Baudet proved some great interviewing skills with an interview with Phil Twyford. Firstly, news director Lillian Hanley spoke with Sina Brown-Davis about what she saw during Tongan Rugby League supporters' celebrations in South Auckland on Saturday. This included police removing a Tongan flag from her daughter, fearing it could be used as a weapon.
Over the past few weeks, there has been much coverage of the overkill by the police in South Auckland during the Rugby League World Cup. There has also been overkill by the media around the, quote, possible violence, unquote, that may occur. There has been criticism around whether the same amount of police force would be used in different parts of Auckland, and comparisons have been made with the Lions Tour as well as the pop-up community events that were planned very quickly following the America's Cup win. This weekend, police were out in huge numbers in what they called was a significant police presence in order to take a zero-tolerance approach to anyone putting the community in danger. Jamie Wall wrote in the spin-off describing how Saturday night was called a major operation by police and whether that was really necessary. The community responded to the overwhelming police presence, saying it was oppressive, alarming, and bizarre. People weren't sure why the police were confiscating alcohol out of cars driving up Mangere Road under the guise of public safety when there were at least 8 alcohol outlets open between Otahuhu and Mangere town centres. The main issue that has been discussed following Saturday's game is the confiscation of flagpoles because of the possibility they may be used as, quote, weapons, unquote. The flags themselves have become a symbol for the community and a well-known image during the tournament. A video on the Herald website shows a police officer taking a pole off a young kid while another young kid looks on. The video is disheartening and unnerving as you witness the silencing of these children, both by the removal of something physical that they have used to express their support and their joy, but also the silencing simply by the presence of a powerful authoritative figure conducting the removal of that object. Those who have criticised the move see it as people having preconceived notions that brown children are violent and is an act of prejudice and racism. Sina Brown-Davis was celebrating the success of the Tongan Rugby League World Cup team on Saturday night with her 15-year-old daughter. They had Tongan flags with them, her daughter had a flag on a pole. They were approached by police officers and told they were allowed to keep the flags but not the pole because it could be used as a weapon. Brown-Davis said this was racist policing and One News filmed the interaction without her permission. It has since garnered many views online and the responses have been both critical of Brown-Davis as well as the police. I spoke with Sina about the racial profiling by the police in this instance. Were you having quite of a celebratory night before the police got involved?
Actually, we were at home because I'm a local resident. I live in Otahuhu. So my daughter and I wanted to go and celebrate with our community. We're also part Tongan as well. So we both got our flags. My daughter had her flag on a flagpole and I had one tied around me. So we went up to join our local community because the community has been celebrating after each game with the World Cup in Otahuhu. It was pretty shocking when we got up the road. We saw that all of the roads were blocked off. And the police presence was, like, huge.
Had it been like that every game?
No, not at every game. There had been, at every other game, there had been a lot more people. So on this past Saturday, there had been probably more police. I think about 200 police up the road there. It's, like, pretty full-on. Lots of, like, police vans, lots of paddy wagons. So it's pretty intimidating.
And how did they go about starting to collect the flagpoles?
We'd noticed them just like going up to people. They'd snapped some people's flagpoles. My daughter and I walked around up and down the street just to see if there were more people there. We were crossing the road towards the McDonald's car park, and in the middle of the road the police stopped my daughter and asked for her flagpole, for her flag. And then I asked the policeman the reason why, And the policeman said the reason why, because it could be used as a weapon. And I got quite upset. My daughter's like 15 years old. She's a Māori Tongan Samoan young woman. She's the most loveliest, passive person I know. You know, so for the police like to take the flagpole off her flag and to like assume that like she could commit violence with it, I found it really upsetting and really racist.
Was there any, you know, were people actually using them as weapons, or was it there?
There was no aggravation on the street. I couldn't understand the heavy police presence because it was mainly families with their little kids. Nobody was using anything as a weapon. The police were like saying that they were like wanted to preempt anything happening, but these were like children and young teenagers. They were confiscating flagpoles or sticks that people had put their flags on. Nothing had happened.
When you'd called them racist, what happened then?
I said that this was like an example of racist over policing, and of course the police go, oh no, this is not racist. I mean, and it obviously was in its application, because they would not treat another community, they would not treat other people that weren't Pacific Islanders or weren't Māoris in this manner.
BFM producer Max Smith found out more about Pacific academic Scott Hamilton saying New Zealand shares some of the blame for conflict on Papua New Guinea's Manus Island.
It's interesting to just reflect on the parts of the subject that haven't been treated in the mainstream media, and there's just been a, I think, quite frustrating failure to contextualise the refugee crisis on Manus Island, because this is going on in the midst of a Melanesian society and an island, an offshore island of Papua New Guinea, which is a very complex and also very a nation that's in turmoil at the moment. And we've had this quite vociferous debate between the different sides about the fate of the refugees on Manus Island, but in many ways we can't completely understand their situation without understanding the political context. There is a very unpopular government in Papua New Guinea, which has been accused by many people of recently stealing an election, using all sorts of illegitimate tactics. This government is being bankrolled by Australia and supported implicitly by New Zealand. And the whole election process, which has just played out in Papua New Guinea, has been vociferously criticised by numerous observers, but it's been supported by Australia and New Zealand. So we have this government in place in Papua New Guinea, which is, you know, deeply unpopular, resented by the regions of Papua New Guinea, including the Manus Island region, and which is absolutely dedicated to working in this almost unwholesome sort of closeness with Australia in terms of implementing your refugee policies. And it's very difficult not to conclude that the government of Peter O'Neill in Papua New Guinea is in power partly because of its willingness to play along with Australia's quite hardline policy on refugees. So unless we understand that context, we're in danger of really ignoring what's going on over there. And there's been a sort of a demonisation, a disappointing demonisation. When they have been mentioned, the Papuan people have been demonised. They've been presented as these dark-skinned savages who are likely to descend upon the Manus refugees if the dubious protection of the Australian security forces is lifted. And there have even been cartoons appearing in the Australian media showing them as cannibals or showing them waving machetes. They are presented almost as another of the hardships which the refugees have had to endure. So not only do they have the oppressive climate, the poor conditions, the lack of educational facilities, health facilities, they also have this dark and menacing indigenous population all around them. And I think that's a very unjust characterisation of the way that the Manus people have behaved towards the refugees. As some commentators have noticed in the last couple of weeks during the crisis, most of the food the refugees have received has come from islanders.
And finally, BFM's Lisa Baudette had some great interviewing skills through an interview with Minister for Transport and Urban Development, Phil Twyford, about a report released by the NZ Transport Agency on the benefits of rail.
It's an economic analysis which looks at the wider benefits and costs of rail. Now, that's calculated in reduced congestion on our roads, reduced deaths and injuries on the roads, road maintenance costs, and a number of other factors. So it's really significant, I think, because the new government is strongly committed to getting a more efficient and safe and low-carbon transport system in place. And this report suggests that increasing the role of rail could be a really important way that we do that.
So yes, like you said, there are financial benefits to having more rail, but there are also environmental ones.
That's right. One of our most important goals is going to be reducing carbon emissions. The transport system is one of the major sources of carbon pollution. And by shifting more freight on rail and coastal shipping, we know we can reduce carbon emissions. And in our cities, by getting people out of their cars into modern rapid transit systems, we know that will make a big difference in reducing carbon emissions too. So it starts to tick all the boxes and shapes up as a really important policy direction for us, and that's to get more out of rail.
Talking about getting passengers off the roads and onto rail, this report shows that there has been a benefit of $1.2 billion alone just from having those passengers off the road, which is a significant number. And obviously, I think that makes quite a solid case for more rail and less roads.
The report shows that there are really big gains in the cities getting people onto rail and rapid transit. And, you know, we can see that in Auckland, the rapid increase in passenger transport, public transport journeys during the time that we've had the new electric trains in Auckland. We know that when the City Rail Link comes in and it doubles the number of trains that can run on the network, allowing trains to run as frequently as every few minutes at peak hour, it's likely that we're going to see bigger and bigger numbers of people using the rail system to get across the city. Our government's committed to rolling out a 21st century rapid transit network across Auckland, and that will include light rail from the city centre up Dominion Road to Roskill and then across to the airport, and also from the city out to West Auckland and the big northwest growth area. It'll get more people at peak hour leaving their cars at home and taking the train. That will deliver big benefits in terms of both reducing congestion and carbon emissions.
So we're talking about congestion wait time. National's transport spokesperson Judith Collins, she claims that new and better roads are also a means to get less congestion wait time. And in all fairness, the Waterview Tunnel that they have implemented, the previous government, it has proven to be rather useful in that regard. So this government has decided to sack the East-West Link imagined by National. Don't you believe that new roads can also be an efficient way to limit traffic?
We do need roads and motorways, of course, and that's not going to change. But I think Aucklanders know that we suffer terrible congestion in the city. It costs the city about $1.3 billion a year in lost productivity, and anyone who has to drive to and from work across town will waste hundreds of hours a year sitting in traffic. What we know is that we can't only just build new motorways and add lanes to the existing motorways, because what happens when you do that? They just magically fill up with cars. It's called induced demand, and the more you build more and more lanes and make it easier for people to drive, the more they will. We have an incredibly high level of private car ownership in Auckland. The way the population's been growing, 825 extra cars a week hitting the road in Auckland. So what we need to do is really make up for the fact that there has been 50 or 60 years of deliberate underinvestment in public transport in Auckland.
So you've mentioned light rail network in Auckland, and if I'm not mistaken, you're also planning on investing in regional rail. Am I right to believe that these investments are going to cost taxpayers quite a lot?
Well, all transport investment costs a lot. The government spends about $4 billion a year on transport. What we're talking about is a rebalancing of the transport budget so that it's not just being spent on a handful of large urban motorway projects as the past national government did. We want to get the best out of all modes. So road, rail in the cities, rail to carry freight. It's a much more economically rational approach to our transport spending. It's about rebalancing away from just having motorways as the default mode. We're not planning to spend more on transport in total. We're talking about rebalancing the approach to the different kinds of transport spending.
That was this week's Bits. To listen to the full interviews, visit 95bfm.com and check out the Bcasts.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.